Welcome to Pop Rocket, our weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. I am Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum, who is off shooting, I think, a pilot for an upcoming television show. So good luck to him with that. Guy's always making very good TV out there. He's holding it down.
He really is. He's killing it.
Very excited.
We have the original heroic trio here. So, we have one special guest we'll announce in just a moment. But we have with us digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
We need an update on your Star Wars saga.
Wow. I don't know.
We also have novelist Margaret Wappler back from her second leg of her book tour. What exciting, exotic places were you? Did you present at this time?
This last leg was Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco.
Wow.
And right. I really can't pick which one of these places is my favorite because those are all pretty fantastic.
How
cities.
Was SF?
I loved it. In the past, I've gone to SF and been like, oh my God, the tech world is just taken over and it's impossible to get any apartment and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know if it seems to have just settled into some new arena of that manifestation.
Maybe
or what.
Because you were
know.
In the Ferlinghetti of it all. You were in a literary state where if you're not in the hustle and bustle of the tech broism, that's a different.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a reading. It was Charlie Jane Anders' reading series at the Makeout Room, which
Ooh,
is.
I love,
do you know that place?
Yes!
It's a proper San Francisco dive.
I liked that.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's still there.
I know.
To
I mean,
be honest.
All the mixed drinks were like were like $9. You know, none of this $14 cocktail nonsense that we've talked about before.
God, when I was 20, it was $6. So that's pretty good for inflation. That's not too bad.
Which of the cities did you have the best meal in?
Oh, gosh. Probably Portland, consistently.
Mm.
I think the food in Portland is really, really good.
Yeah.
There's a breakfast place that I pretty much made my second home called Sweetie.
I've been there.
Oh, you have?
Northwest breakfast. I've said this on the show before. It just really puts most other places, especially Southern California, to shame.
Oh, of course.
Like Portland, Seattle, their breakfast game is just out of this world.
Super tight.
Yes. All right. Well, glad to have you back. And hopefully at some point we can have all four of the OGs here. But it'll happen soon. You want to introduce our special guest?
Our special guest host is my pup, Flynn, who is laying on the carpet right now looking kind of concerned because he probably wants food.
What breed is Flynn here?
Flynn is a Chihuahua Italian Greyhound mix with a little bit of Terrier thrown in.
It's like a Grey Chihuahua, something, I don't know.
Grey Wawa.
Yeah, a Grey Wawa. Okay.
He's basically a Chihuahua on stilts.
Okay.
He has long legs and the Chihuahua face.
There you go.
Yeah.
Excellent.
He's
All right.
a cutie.
Welcome, Flynn. He's like, whatever. All right. This week's show, we are going to be talking about the art of the pop culture comeback. But first, we're going to start with a conversation of a little award show that was held this past weekend called the Emmys. And in hindsight, we probably should have made that our main topic, but none of us seem to have remembered that the show even existed or was going to air until late in the week. And it seems like the rest of the country was like us because the news just came in today that it was the lowest rated Emmys ever. I'm going to come back to that point later. I do want to start with the fact that people who missed it, it sounds like they missed a pretty good show. Winner, you watched the whole thing. You thought it was on point and on time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, like it was, I couldn't believe at 7:55 when they were like, thanks everybody, have a good night. I was like, whoa. When you never have to add the extension to a program, that's saying something.
How did Kimmel do as host?
You know, this is the thing. Like, people were on Twitter this morning or Monday morning quarterbacking because they felt like Jill Soloway made the comment, topple the patriarchy, which was outstanding.
Thank you to the trans community for your lived lives. We need to stop violence against transgender women and topple the patriarchy. Topple the patriarchy!
And then he made a comment afterwards about sort of, it was a joke.
Right.
And this is the thing that I'm kind of annoyed by, even though as outgoing I am about my militancy, I want everybody to be treated with respect and have a voice and say what they want to say. But let's not forget, he's not like running for, that doesn't even count anymore. He's not.
He might run for president.
he's a comedian. He's a talk show host. So he's going to make joke and poke fun. His job is to keep it light and have levity.
Right.
I think sometimes he is a little too dry.
But explain the joke that he made afterwards. He kind of, you know, right, so scratched his chin and playfully said, I'm not sure if that's good for me, topple
yeah,
the patriarchy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was totally funny. It was
fine. Yeah, it's totally funny.
It was playful and silly. And
he had a show called The Man Show. It's a great callback
exactly.
to, you know, I don't think that's good for me. It would be good for him. But the thing is, like, he didn't know Jill Soloway. You gotta think about it. He didn't know Jill Soloway was gonna win. So to have some improvisational commentary right after that, that's skill. You take skill. If I'd come out and be like, oh, that was great. Topple the patriarchy!
I only caught the first hour, but I thought the opening, I mean, the opening video bit is, it was fine. I mean, you've seen some variation
kind
where...
Kind of okay,
yeah, he inserted himself into a bunch of, like, different television shows, including... Right. People versus OJ, Modern Family.
Yeah, I was going to say it was kind of all based on trying to get to the Emmys
right.
on time
we've
in
seen,
LA, which
we've
is
seen
like,
that
you know,
bit
classic
before.
Sketch of yeah. LA traffic, et cetera, et cetera.
I thought the opening monologue was, it was funny. It was brisk. He didn't overstay his welcome.
Right.
It wasn't painful.
Right.
And we could go back to Key and Peele doing the VMAs, but we don't need to go back
there.
Oh,
we could go back to Chris Rock doing the Oscars.
Right. I mean, a lot of people doing the, basically everyone doing the Oscars for the last 10
Let's
years.
Let's not hurt ourselves
so
like that.
I thought he did, I thought, again, based on what I saw in that first hour at least, I thought he actually did a pretty decent job all said, so.
Marsha Clark being there, to me, was the highlight, the true highlight. Sarah Paulson said it alone. She, you know, like, are we supposed to all get up and stand up and apologize to Marsha Clark? I don't know, maybe? I just think that I respect her. A lot more now knowing that she went, I mean, we've talked about the show ad nauseum on this show, but I do respect her a lot more. And I do see her. I mean, I literally was like, oh, my God, Marsha Clark. I never said 22 years ago. I was like, ugh, I hate her. And now I'm like, oh, my God, she's there.
Yeah. The moment where Sarah Paulson thanked her in the speech and said, we all owe you a collective apology, I thought was really powerful. And I thought that her bringing Marsha Clark in such an obvious way was also had this resonance with just giving cred to working mothers because that is so much the Marsha Clark story, that she had these two children and that she was taking on this absolute mammoth case of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And, you know, she didn't play every single card correctly, but she certainly gave it her all. Nobody could say anything different on that.
Yeah.
And I think that was really important for her to bring up.
Yeah.
We don't need to revisit the show because we've already spent a lot of time talking about the People versus OJ. But I think, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, one of the conclusions that we came up with last time is that if the show probably did more to rehabilitate any one single image, it would have been Marsha Clark's, right?
Yes. Yeah, because it's made me hate OJ. I always had like some sympathy for OJ, but I absolutely hate his ass. So, yes, it ties in perfectly with the comeback.
We'll come back to the awards themselves in terms of who won what, but any other highlights from just the broadcast itself, the show as a show that stood out to the two of you?
I thought that the way Jimmy Kimmel pointed out diversity and Hollywood's propensity to be self-congratulatory about diversity was pretty on point, you know? Like, he hit the mark and he teased it, but he didn't go overboard. And his whole performance felt very natural to me, very comfortable.
Yes.
I really appreciated that.
Right.
There wasn't a lot of, like, showmanship. It's not the Oscars. This isn't about, like, the big bonanza spectacle. It's a little more homey, the Emmys in general. And I thought the tenor of his performance fit that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that joke also worked because one of the first winners was Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang for Master of None. And so already you have sort of like non-white people up there accepting the award. You know, Alan Yang basically created the most Asian American moment in like award show history in his thank you speech. Using math, yes. I don't necessarily agree with that math, and I think one can pick at it at the sides, but shout out to Alan Yang for doing that. Like,
that's why it's an entertainment.
But, I mean, how many people under the age of 40 know who Long Duk Dong is? Like, who still watches 16?
A lot of people.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I could be wrong.
Long Duk Dong is like, you know.
But fading fast.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
For good reason,
all right.
Before that, it was the little kid from
Short Round.
So, I mean...
But I saw on Twitter today, Oliver, that you thought that his references were quite male-centric.
Oh, yeah, because everyone he talked about in terms of... So, for people who didn't catch it, which is, again, apparently most of America, Alan Yang, who's the co-writer and maybe co-creator of Master of None. Anyway, he won for the Emmy for writing. He basically said that there's the same number of Italians and Asians in the United States, even though Asians are really not one ethnic group in the way that Italians
true?
Are. Yeah, 17 million. I think number around
there.
Yeah,
that's what he
and
said
And that
anyway.
He's pointing out that Italians have The Sopranos, they have Rocky, they have The Godfather,
true.
And Asians have Long Duk Dong. that was his point, that we have time to we need more time to catch up,
and
basically.
That's an insult to George Takei.
Well,
by
it's
the
also
way.
Like,
thank you.
Yeah.
First
like,
thing I thought of too.
Yeah. Not all Italians are happy with those depictions.
Right, because they're all,
you know, those are all mafia movies.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
I didn't realize Rocky shows. Is, but I've never seen Rocky.
Well, that's where age comes into play. Like age comes into play, which, you know, they won for writing a show that really poked. Parents was nominated, right? Was that
yeah,
the episode that
it
won?
Was.
Yeah.
Completely indicative of an age scenario
right,
where
right.
they're just like not the same age as, you know, their parents had a different experience of being 26 versus their experience of being 26 or whatever. So like that's to me where age starts coming into play.
Mm-hmm.
The other point, though, everything he mentions are just men.
Yeah.
So are there no women that enter into it? No Italian American actresses or characters and no
Margaret Cho? Excuse me. Margaret fucking Cho?
Check that. See, this is why we have to crush the patriarchy.
Yep,
down with the
that's
patriarchy.
Right.
Highlights for you. Other highlights from the show.
Oh, God. You know, there was obviously Sarah. Oh, Courtney B. Vance went in and just pointing to Angela Bassett, his boo, the entire way into the backstage.
Wait, are they a couple?
Yes. They're married.
Yeah, they're married.
I know.
I didn't
keep up on this. I'm sorry.
They've been
my
married
bad.
For 15 years.
Good for them. Well, that's awesome.
So this is why I liked it. Sterling K. Brown said, "I got the hottest chick in the game wearing my chain." And he was talking about his wife, which is a reference to the Jay-Z lyric.
Right.
So then Courtney B. Vance says it too, perfectly, flawlessly, about Angela Bassett. And then John Oliver.
Poor British bloke.
He's like, and I've got my wife in a chain, and I don't know. And so, like, that was so cute.
It was
just
cute.
Super cute. I really.
And obviously not planned. I mean, this is them riffing.
Right.
Yeah.
Those
going
are
the
fun
flow.
Moments. And the Stranger Things kids, they were having the time of their lives, and you know, the E did something funny with the glam bot, which I don't know if you guys saw, but
I didn't see that.
What is the glam bot?
E, oh God, E's such a disaster. E did a basically a camera that was on a track. It captures you in real time and then it slows it down right as you're making your turn. So they're trying to get away from doing like the 360 thing, which was a little too gross and navel gazy. And then they were also trying to get away from the manicure cam.
I was just gonna say the nail cam.
The nail
like,
cam, which was so ridiculous. So this is their response to, why don't we just capture Giphy moments?
Right.
And everybody who did it didn't really seem to know when it did it or when. So there's a lot of people like with their eyes closed in slow motion, or people who are just like, like, and so I was like,
Giphy Moments is my new favorite TV show name.
There you go.
I need that.
Yeah. Someone locked that down immediately.
But you wrote in your notes about, we have to bring this up, John Benet.
Well, we'll get the ratings
okay,
in a second.
Okay.
I have to say, a highlight, and again, I only watched the first hour.
Okay.
I did not realize that no SNL player has ever won, and Kate McKinnon won.
Wait, really?
Yes. Well, I mean, won while they were still on the show. Obviously, former SNL folks. I mean,
right.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus basically won every Emmy in the existence of the show.
But as a cast member,
Kate McKinnon was the first. And I'm thinking, I think part of it was the Ghostbusters thing. I mean, not that she hasn't been killer on the show.
She's been strong since day one.
And she has been strong. And she's playing Hillary Clinton right now, which
right.
is like a big kind of showcase type of sketch.
Sure.
And I love the fact that she was truly kind of like rattled from the win. I love it when people get up there and are actually grateful and truly surprised.
Yeah.
Another speech like that for me, I mean, the one that I felt like, oh, he's really feeling it was Sterling K. Brown. Like when he got up there, he was so, you know, sucking in his breath and just being like, holy shit, I can't believe
we
I'm
live
up here.
For those moments.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what you watch for.
And when people get up there, like they know they're going to win and they pull their reading glasses out and that piece of paper that's been tucked firmly in their coat jacket, all typed up, two-spaced, you know, Arial font. Like, I'm like, come on.
And when they start, like, thanking, like, more than two people at Gersh or whatever, I'm like, sit down.
Don't. And, Louis Anderson. Thank God he was the first one to win. It was so awkward. He's like, Marsha, Pamela, Gene, Frank.
These people I've never bothered to learn their last names.
Or who the fuck is that? He thanked literally like his entire kindergarten class. Like Sally, Jim. I was like, wrap it up, Louie. Wrap it up, Lou. Wrap that shit up, B.
Let's talk more about who won the awards. And I think I've been trying to figure out if critics felt like they were surprises or not surprises, and obviously it's been a little bit split. So on the one hand, you have people like Rami Malek winning for Mr. Robot, which was unexpected, and then also heavy, hardcore fan favorite Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black winning for Best Actress in Drama Series. So that's unexpected, but then you have Game of Thrones winning for Best Drama, mm-hmm. and you have, I guess, Veep winning for Outstanding Comedy, surprising only because it's usually Modern Family has that unlock. But then, again, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I think she was fantastic this past season, but she's won 5 years in a row at this point.
Yeah. And I know her dad died, and I love her.
Yes.
And the speech was very touching.
Her speeches are always good because they always do little bits, and this was funny and heartfelt.
Yeah.
What did we think about who won? And I think one of the things that's worth noting is that this was the first year that the Emmys opened up the finalist voting to a bigger body. It used to be in smaller subsections, sort of. I think the Oscars did or still do something like that. But in this case, it was the entire voting body got to vote on the awards. And that's why they think that there are some unexpected winners within this.
I'm not going to name names, but some nominees felt like that kind of tilted things.
Really?
Yeah.
Meaning what?
Meaning it tilted it out of favor for some, in favor for others. I think Julia's win, listen, I love her. Like I said, I love
yes.
her. But when you win 5 times in a row,
yes.
it just starts feeling like super unfair.
Right.
And I would be, I'm sorry, I love to win whatever. I love to win. I love to win like a speeding ticket.
There you go.
In case if the cop doesn't show up, I'm like, I win. but like if you win 5 times, I would just start feeling like bad for everybody else.
And it was the same thing with Bryan Cranston winning. It felt like 18 years in a row for Breaking Bad. It's not because he's not good.
Yeah.
But I would hate to be the second most talented actor in this same era because you just got edged out.
Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that she won in this election year is really why she won in a way. And she made note of that in her speech that, like, the show has almost turned into a reality show, like a documentary. And I think the fact that they have tapped into this nerve line that is so eerily prescient and happening right now is part of the reason why it just couldn't. Like, I do think next year, like, it'll feel very egregious if they win again, if she wins again.
Right.
But I think in an election year, you just had to give it to her.
Any awards that it bugged you that whoever won or what or the show winning just kind of got
Game of Thrones.
Because you don't think it deserves it or because there was a better show? What would you have preferred?
People even shit on this season and said it wasn't that good. So I just feel like there's a prestige thing that always goes on. And I just wish people, like, that's why I'm excited about what Netflix is going to do next year when it's time for, like, the Stranger Things all the other shows that have come on. Like, maybe the Get Down for set design. I mean, nothing else other than that. But but they're going to disrupt. I like disruptors. The Amazon has disrupted, and that's great. I'm biased. I wanted Anthony to win, but Jeffrey is great. But there's disruptors in the space, so I think that's making networks nervous. But I think I would rather see disruptors disrupt other than the same old same.
You know, it's funny because I am a Game of Thrones fan, obviously, as I talked about many times on the show. And I thought this season was pretty stellar and had some of the best episodes that the show's ever had. That said, I was even bored that they were winning as much as they did.
Right.
Yeah. I felt like, you know, I give it to some other people. Give it to some other folks. I mean, I have not caught up on the Americans yet, but I keep hearing over and over and over again that is super amazing and has been doing great work. And so it always turns into that when you see these shows just absolutely dominate for as long as they do.
Yeah.
And I do have a feeling that Game of Thrones, because it's going to be on now for another 2-3 seasons, they're probably going to start ignoring it. And then on its last season, they'll be like all
right,
the awards.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I thought Maggie Smith winning for it seemed like the 1,000th time for Downton Abbey.
And she wasn't even there.
You're not even there.
Which was, Kimmel made a bit from that. And
or the guy from Bloodline.
And, I mean, everyone.
Who even watches that show?
Everyone.
What show is that? What channel is that on?
I'm not mad at Ben Mendelsohn winning for that, even though I've never seen the show. I think Bloodline's on. I think the fact that we
Netflix.
Can't remember the net. What? Yeah, maybe.
Who's Ben Mendelsohn? Wilson.
He was in a Mississippi Grind. He's going to be in the new Star Wars film.
No.
He's an older dude.
Bye.
But yeah, Maggie Smith winning for a show that everyone, I think, universally agrees that Downton Abbey just fell off a cliff the more time that goes by.
And,
I'm sure maybe
time.
She's the best part of it.
Yes.
But and maybe this is the problem. You had three different actresses from Game of Thrones going against each other, and maybe they canceled each other out.
Well, I do think that happened so much at the Emmys that, I mean, there were several categories where there was multiple people from a certain show nominated, and that just gets kind of awkward.
Like, you know what I...
Thinking about all of them being like, well, I want to root for myself. Right, I also want to root for them. Like, what do I do?
I do have to say, though, I think what I'm 100% tired of, and I didn't realize I was tired of it, unless the people make fun of Juliana Rancic and Ross the intern. The red carpet is just a drag.
I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I just always go on to, like, Tom and Lorenzo and just read their coverage.
Right. Ooh, I need to start reading that.
You mean for all award shorts?
All award. I mean, it's just I was watching it yesterday, and it's so obvious that the producers are controlling everything. So it's like you'll be having like a deep in conversation with someone and you can just feel since the producer is in somebody's ear, like they're done. They're boring. We've got someone else coming up. Okay. See you later, Matt LeBlanc. Oh, it's Tina Fey. And it's like that whole thing, which is why when Amy Schumer made the OB tampon comment, I was like, that's how she's clearly drunk, but that's how you shake it up. That's how you shake shit up. And you make it fun because I just cannot stand listening to Juliana Rancic. Yeah.
Isn't it also the case that if you want to know who is best and worst dressed, they have those listicles up before the end of the broadcast?
Right.
You don't have to wait for the week until Us Weekly or EW has their feature on it. So there's no you don't need to be there for the live on the red carpet. You're going to get the same content
later.
You're
going to get the same content.
All right. Let's talk about the ratings because this was the worst rated Emmys in the history of the Emmys.
Seriously?
Yeah. The worst ratings they ever had. So, I mean, them losing to Sunday Night Football, that is kind of understandable only because football's huge in America. Mm-hmm. They also lost to CBS's JonBenet Ramsey special
dude, that is so understandable. Like, if I had known that I was on last night,
you would not have DVR'd JonBenet and watched the Emmys live? That's how you would have rolled?
I would have watched JonBenet live and DVR'd.
Yeah, I was kind of mad when I tuned in and I was like an hour past when it.
I mean, that is some dishy business.
Oh, my God.
And
who are you two?
Wait a second. Hold up.
Ridiculous
hold up.
Camp. I know it was a real person. I'm very sorry for her loss. Right. But
of life. Her loss of life.
Winter, you're about to say something.
No,
I'm a very sensitive person.
Margaret, you are traveled out. Your entire empathetic thread is gone. No, listen.
It'll be
restored momentarily.
Isn't it part of it that the reason why award shows in the past had larger ratings is because we all sort of watch the same television shows and movies? We had more skin in the game. And at the point now where our tastes have sort of animized, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, the compulsion to have to watch the award show, we're not as invested in it. I mean, we still have our favorite shows, but the award show itself doesn't feel like it's that special I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe the award show should just exist for the super fans, but it's not something that's supposed to be a television event, capital T, capital E.
I think the older we're getting, it's starting to seem like a little annoying. Like the whole lead up and the run up to it is annoying. And the amount of parties that go on, everybody's shifting game. Like I went to the Comedy Central party on Saturday. It's usually the night after the awards, or it's usually after the awards that night. Mm. Budgets are different, marketing is different, social media is rampant. When people kind of like who they like and want who they want to win.
Right.
3 hours is a long fucking time. It's a long time, and plus, honestly, I think that we are so. Immersed in this political, election.
That's a good point.
That looking at rich people get awards for making tons of money seems a little annoying.
Yeah, and I also think there's something about access where, like, when these award shows first started coming on, it was like you didn't see, like, Marlon Brando just out there in the world.
Right.
You didn't see the star, Us Magazine's stars, they're just like us kind of coverage. Like, you really only had this limited access to all those people.
Right.
And now we are, like, drowning
in
and inundated in their lives and their private materials and whatever else. And it's like, you know, I really am not that thrilled anymore at sort of, like, the random sighting of, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Like, it just doesn't have the burn that I think it did in, like, 1978 or something.
But the whole thing, but the award show, watching it live, is that you can see if your favorite thing or person won. But for you, you said you would have rather watched the JonBenet Ramsey thing and DVR'd the Emmys.
Yeah, because you can go the next morning and just see, oh, that's who won.
Okay.
Great. And also, I feel like it just isn't a true bearer of taste or standards or whatever. Like, does anybody ever really start, like, watching something because it won an Emmy? I'm just not so sure. I think that might happen with Oscars, but with Emmys, I just don't think it has the same kind of cred.
I was more surprised by who lost, because it, to me, is a barometer of who's. I mean,
so
Modern
example,
Family.
Yeah.
Not at. I mean, you know, they're getting to the end of the road for their work and their efforts, and
I mean, they've been on since the Carter administration, right? I mean, I seriously can't remember how long they've been on the air now.
They've been on the air for 7 years, so like that's a good long time.
The whole Obama run, there you go.
Yeah, so like they like, and they've benefited off that as well, heartily. So I don't know, like television. If I had to say the one thing that could have messed them up completely, having Jimmy Kimmel host is weird, because a lot of young people don't watch Kimmel. So if they're trying to get like that young demo, that 18 to 35. You're talking to people who watch him like in blips the next day on the internet. They need to start really amping up the type of people that they have hosting. They need to diversify the type of content that they're producing. I really wanted a musical number. I don't know why. I just wanted a musical number. I wanted something to switch, to flip the game up.
Well, I mean, with Grease live winning, you know, over Lemonade.
It was begging for it.
Well, yeah. Well, Beyonce wasn't going to show up to anything. She was going to lose. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, no way. Right, she stayed within 100 miles of that.
Yeah.
We got to wrap this up. Who would be the ideal host to get a younger audience to watch?
That's a really hard. Ask Margaret and come back to me. I have to think about this.
Well, I was going to ask, like, who is their audience? That's what I've never really
understood.
I think
understood that's a great question,
too. Emmys,
right.
You know?
I think it's people like us, except not, because you're not watching it.
Right,
so,
but
yeah.
I also think it's honestly, like, industry to industry. It is an
it's
industry
totally
production.
A B2B. It's not being B2C, now it's B2B.
Yeah, it is. And I just think people outside of, like, New York and L.A. don't really care about it. It's totally a pat on the back for people in the industry. And, like, I'm not even faulting that necessarily, but I'm just saying,
well, that's what
like,
it is. It's an awards for, it's an industry show. Right. All right. You have been listening to our discussion of the Emmys here on Pop Rocket. We will be right back to talk about the comeback.
What's the deal with Brexit? Have you seen Happy Valley yet?
How do British people pronounce Edinburgh, Leicester, or Norwich?
Not like that.
Are you tired of getting your world news from reliable sources, often with no puns or sexual innuendo?
Why was there a butcher's hat haunting Coronation Street?
What's Coronation Street, and why is Dave Holmes obsessed with it?
International Waters pairs a team of comedians in LA against a team of comedians in London in a pop culture battle royale. Join us once a fortnight to hear the best comedians in the world trade jokes and stories and maybe even learn something at the same time. International Waters with me, Dave Holmes. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I am your guest host today, Oliver Wang, sitting in for Guy Branum. With me in the studio, we have
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and
Flynn Wappler.
Yes, Flynn Wappler.
Oh, I
Flynn
see.
Wappler Earl. Excuse me.
Ooh,
ooh,
yeah. Fancy Esquire.
DDS,
private detective.
Private detective.
So one of the first awards last night was Louis. We mentioned this briefly at the Emmys. Was Louis Anderson winning for, I guess, best supporting actor in a comedic role for Baskets, which is a show that I forgot was even on the air. And Louis Anderson, I think, qualifies as sort of a comeback figure. I mean, I think a lot of us vaguely remember him from his stand up from, I want to say the 80s, maybe it was the 90s, a little bit more recent. But he's been in the game for a long time and has been out of public view. And part of why we like watching things like award show is sometimes we get to see someone who is of a certain age, if I can be diplomatic about it, have a return to the spotlight. So we wanted to talk about the comeback. Who are some of our favorite examples? And I think more importantly, why is it something that we as fans of pop culture really like to glom onto and really root for the idea of someone being able to make a comeback? So let's just start with some of our favorite examples of people who've made a comeback and why. What is it about that gives you joy, basically? Let's start with Margaret.
You know, I think comebacks are really powerful because everybody likes the story of redemption. Everybody likes the story of forgiveness. Everyone likes to see someone who was down on their luck, who had a setback, fight back against it and come back to rise again. And I think that is just an eternal story. And I think it all happens in our lives. Like, we all have had comebacks in our own personal lives on some level or another. And I think when we see actors go through it, it really destabilizes the most harmful parts of the myth of actors or actresses, that they can, like, never fail, that they can never have a setback. And when you see them have one, it's actually a potent reminder that they're human beings. You know, that they aren't just these icons and idols on the screen, that they really do live lives. They have divorces. They have affairs. They, you know, do things wrong in relationships and career and whatever else. And so I think it's just really, you know, what's the famous, like, F. Scott Fitzgerald quote about, like, there are no second lives?
Second acts
right. in American lives. And I think it's, like, it's a fight back against that kind of quote.
Okay.
You know, that idea that there is only one chance that you get. It's not true, actually. You can have many, many, many resurrections.
So who are some of your exemplars of who's made the ideal comeback?
Well, it's interesting because when you were introducing the topic, you talked about it in somewhat in terms of age. And I think one of the most... to me, one of the first comeback stories I was aware of was Drew Barrymore. And hearing that she was this complete down-and-out drug addict kid for a while. I mean, after doing Poltergeist and these other movies.
Poltergeist, E.T.
Sorry.
E.T. And Firestarter.
So her and E.T., like all these roles that she was in as a young kid, and then she goes off, or even simultaneously is doing all these drugs. And that was such a sad, tragic thing. And then to see her come back and become this woman who... has her own production company and has directed films and
cosmetics company.
Yeah, I mean, she has really resurrected herself a million times over. So I think that was the first time I remember being aware of that narrative.
And I find that I love the Drew Barrymore aspect of that, because Drew Barrymore and Robert Downey Jr. are the two most notable because they grew up in Hollywood. So it was, they were like prey to the system to fall apart. And I think Drew was the first, one of the first examples of someone calling out the fact that not only was she manipulated, but her mother was manipulated and her father had manipulated them. And it was like a shit show all around. So for her to kind of get to where she is now, which is, I mean, from all I hear is that she's still pretty quirky, but that she is, she's a mother of two. She's built a quite a brand for herself. I think that that's what she's done is still like one of those classic cases of a comeback. And especially in the case of Robert Downey Jr., I love everything about his comeback. Everything.
Right.
The man is like flawless in his return because he is acutely aware of the fact that he fucked up a lot. I mean, from the moment he was first arrested all the way until 20 years later when he finally sobered up. I mean, he was given chance after chance after chance and screwed up chance after chance after chance.
But why wouldn't that make people tired, less likely to want to root for him?
Because
they would just
talented.
Feel like they pissed away. Okay,
he's talented.
Because he's talented. All right.
You know, and the thing that's a problem for Lindsay, as much as I hate to say this, is that Lindsay can't make a comeback because we don't know actually how good she would be now because so many of her performances were literally 15 years ago when she was a teenager. So unless she had been having a consistent brand that she was building up towards, we'd be like, she's wasting all this good talent. But now it's been so long since the talent was present. There's really no way to know. How talented would she be now if given the chance?
Do you think that because Drew Barrymore and Robert Downey Jr. came from these actor families, we were more willing to give them a second chance? Where it's almost like, well, we can't just have the lineage die because these two got hooked,
got into
drugs, whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas Lindsay Lohan is almost like this outlier. You know what I mean? She just kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, as far as I know, her family's not an acting family.
But I think if she did a great role, I think people would be behind it for
all the reasons
that we've laid out here.
But you have to like get people invested in a comeback, and
but so many people are with her.
So many people, not really anymore. I think people are like completely done. It's like with Christian Slater. Like Christian Slater has had to make a comeback, and his approach has been a little bit more subtle. She would take a comeback and really make it like into everything. And it's almost like when Britney shaved her head, went through that entire process, and then came back and made this triumphant return, but she's still not herself and she's still not who she is. So we're living in the memory of who she is.
Because I don't feel like she's made a comeback.
It's very inauthentic what we are living
off of. But wasn't she always
plastic
on some level?
It's literally like finding a jelly bean in the middle of a car console and eating it because you love that jelly bean.
I think there are other examples.
I did that last week.
Margaret came up with a really great list of comebacks. Sorry, I just got distracted by the jelly bean thing. I'm like, ew, that just sounds wrong.
You put down shame.
Yeah, thank you. I love you.
You put down John Travolta, who came back with
Pulp Fiction.
And Travolta was not someone who I think had like a dark period. I think that was more about nostalgia, is that we grew up with him in the 70s and he disappeared for the bulk of the 80s. And then he came back in the 90s with Pulp Fiction. And it was sort of a familiar face that had, for whatever reason, kind of disappeared from view. And now he's back and that's great. And so I think that's another kind of comeback, which is it's about tapping into our own memories of who they used to be. Surprisingly, I don't feel like Henry Winkler never really had that moment, even though post-Fonzie, he completely disappeared. And then he came back as Bob Loblaw in
Scott Baio.
Chachi. No, it was Henry Winkler.
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't Henry Winkler in Arrested Development?
Come on, guys. He was on it at some point somewhere, but Bob Loblaw was Scott Baio.
Oh, God.
Who played Chachi.
Oh. And who's now like a Trump supporter, so we can't really
Even fuck him. I don't even know. I never thought in a million years we'd be talking about Chachi again in the same year.
But to come back to John Travolta, I think part of the key of his comeback was that he came back in the right vehicle. Like, he came back in a movie that had almost as much, like, kitsch and camp value as Saturday Night Fever. You know what I mean? Like, he came back into this vehicle that had the right kind of circumstance for him. And it also was Tarantino at his top. And so it's like, we're just going to completely trust Tarantino to bring this guy back. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it seemed like a really bold move. Like, a lot of the coverage of that movie revolved around, oh my God, here's Travolta again.
Yeah, right.
At first, anyway.
The examples that I thought of, especially because you had covered, I think, the worlds of television and movies really well. We're really sports figures, and that is a ready-made narrative. It's the athlete going for the last, you know, hurrah before they ride off into the sunset. And my first memory, in the same way that Drew Barrymore was your first memory, I thought of Jimmy Connors, who in 1991, at the age of something like 39, made it to the semis of the U.S. Open. And I just remember it being such a huge story because Connors' best days had really been in the late 1970s, and here he was, you know, at way past a reasonable prime. You know, he once described it as the best 11 days of his life in terms of just, you know, working his way through the competition. More recently, I was thinking about Peyton Manning when he first joined the Broncos after coming back from neck surgery, after the Colts had cut him. In the most recently would be Kobe Bryant. Even though that dude was washed and his body was completely failing, I just wanted to see him have one more great game. And that's what he gave us with his very last game where he went for 60. And when I think about it within the athletic context, I think part of why we like the comeback for athletes is it is a fight against the inevitability of time, which is really about a fight against the inevitability of death. Right?
Yeah.
We like comebacks because we don't want to feel like we're going to become useless and we're going to wither away, and we want to fight against the darkness. Basically.
I think that's really true. I mean, I think that people... It helps them stoke the fantasy that they could still do a slam dunk at age 35, 40, whatever. And so when you see a great athlete come back and do that at a point in their lives that are considered past their prime, it's a really powerful message to everyone that, like, we can all do it.
I feel like it's harder for musicians. And we talked a little bit about Britney, but because music genres are so tied to a particular era, I'm sure there are examples of artists who have come back, you know, they were big in their 20s and they come back in their 60s because they've cut a jazz standard album or something. But it's harder for me to come up with great examples of musical comebacks. Anything occur to either the two of you?
Well, I thought about Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind. You know, he was disappeared for a while and he came back with this album. And I think the key to why that album got a lot of attention is because he didn't try to be a young man. And I think that is key to music comebacks in particular, that they don't try to return to some kind of spark of youth that they don't have anymore, but that they really do honor the current place that they're at because that's authentic. So, I mean, I you know, there are sort of countless, I think, like male dad rock era musicians who have come back with that type of album, you know?
Right. And, oh, well, yeah, like Guns N' Roses. I mean, going to see Guns N' Roses 25 years after they were relevant was something to see. And it also really, really made me feel old because I thought, you know, I was 12 when Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 came out. And that was like T2 soundtrack, like height of popularity, like Stephanie Seymour marrying Axl. And then to like go to Coachella, everybody rushed to see them at the main stage that night. But like Axl's literally sitting in a chair the entire time with his leg out of commission. Because he broke it or twisted it or tore something. And it's like, ah, buddy. It's not disheartening because they sounded great. But you almost want to hear them in front of like a hologram of them in their in their youth. Because I got to tell you, you put a 4K camera on Axl and then project it on a 20-foot screen. And you're just like, fuck. It was rough.
Yeah, and there's been countless, like, reunion tours, right? Yeah. Like, everybody from, like, the Pixies to Pavement to whoever.
But that does not a comeback make, though. Just because you're still touring doesn't mean that you've come back from sort of whatever the abyss is or obscurity. It just means that you can still grind out a living doing, you know, all these reunion tours for aging, I guess at this point, us, Gen Xers, I suppose.
Yeah, although I think it depends on the tour, and I think it depends on the reunion. I mean, I think some of them get more traction and feel more, like, true, like, contributions to the band legacy than others. You know, some of them really do feel like, oh, we're filing a paycheck. I mean, I don't fault anyone for trying to make a living.
True.
I don't know if it's ever going to happen, but I would be really curious to see a successful hip-hop comeback by an older rapper, because if there's one music, and much like rock and roll, that we have this obsession with youth within, it's rap.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's definitely ended many a career of artists whose main problem is they simply got into their 30s and 40s. And so it'd be interesting to see if there's going to be a 50-year-old rapper that can sort of make it back into some kind of spotlight.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the secret, like, underlying message about comebacks is that some people just leave these businesses, these creative businesses, because they're not sustainable unless they are like at the absolute top of their game.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them just have to leave because they can't make a living. They can't keep it going. They can't have a family while touring, or they can't have a family while shooting movies in, you know, four different continents. Like, it's a hard life. And I think when I was doing research about, you know, who I would like to see make a comeback, it was interesting to me how many of like the 90s actresses have kind of fallen off the map, because they're kind of at the point now where like maybe they're having kids, and like that's not a really – Hollywood's not a good atmosphere to do that in.
Well, it was like looking at Kirsten Dunst last night at the Emmys, thinking to myself, she was the hottest thing.
Right.
Yeah.
She was the hottest thing. I'm not talking about aesthetically. I'm talking about just like her entire brand was like heat.
Yeah.
And when I first moved,
fantastic actress.
Oh yeah, great to look at. Like, really, you know,
smart.
And then, you know, you kind of see her. She's gone to television. She's done that. And some people, like, then you see Carrie Russell.
From The Americans.
Who, you know,
killing it on that show.
And comfortable with her place. You also have to find comfort in it. It's something that you were saying, like, when you were saying, you both were kind of saying and alluding to it, but, like, you know, to be in hip hop, you have to sustain that. You can't be coming back talking about, like, you were talking about eating shrimp and steak, and now you're talking about, like, standing in line for the EBT check. You can't go you can't go forward to back. Like, nobody's going to want to hear all that shit. So, and the same thing, I think, works in television. If you were a big film star, and now you're just kind of like, I feel like Jennifer Aniston's always gonna have money as long as she's talking about her dry ass eyes. But if you can go comfortably,
I didn't know she had dry eyes.
Girl, she was dry eyes every commercial break last night. The driest of her friends can tell, but they don't know she has dry eyes. God, well, I didn't need to know either. How about that? If you can go from film, if you can go from television to film, that used to be like the whole
Yes.
You've made it.
Yes. Yeah. Now it's the inverse.
If you
go from film
because that
to
is comfortable. That is a paycheck. Right. And you can make that shit while living in the same city.
Exactly.
And you can have a job that
and
gives
you
like long term. Yeah. I mean, hopefully.
Well,
if the show is good enough.
If the show is good enough. But like, I don't know that she'd ever be comfortable having to go back to a television show. I think she's trying to stave that off, but the reality is it's coming at her fast.
You're talking about Kirsten Dunst?
I'm talking about, Kirsten's in it.
Okay.
I'm talking about Jennifer Aniston. Yeah. I think about, like, you know, she's due for, there's also like when you have a comeback, I think a comeback can be different things. It can be you've been gone for a long time and you come back and you actually land it or you kind of miss it. Vanilla Ice blowing his wad doing Ice Ice Baby week one of Dancing with the Stars, or MC Hammer, you know, coming back and now he's doing like Stick'em commercials on Hook Stick'ems on the wall, stuff like that. Like, you have to know your place in the comeback. If Hammer wanted to come back and be taken seriously, fail. He's like, I'm just going to poke fun at this shit now. There's nothing else I can do. Then that's fine. You're comfortable with it. But forcing somebody to understand their place in this business now is, I think, one of the hardest things for celebrities and talent is to recognize, like, listen, yes, you used to be super duper hot shit.
But that moment's over. You got to find something new.
I think Winona Ryder has managed her comeback pretty well.
Yes, she stayed under the radar.
She's stayed under the radar, but she's only done print, like, features, basically. Like, she hasn't really put herself out there on, like, tons of red carpets. She's not trying to be in every magazine. It's much more like, I'm going to sit down with the reporter, myself in one case for Nylon, but I'm going to sit down with the reporter and I'm going to have a one-on-one and really kind of make it meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think for her and her brand, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
You know, and like, she's pretty savvy that way, and that, like, she's on this show, Stranger Things. It's been a huge hit for her, but she knows that that is one way for her to come back in, but there's a lot of control she has to take of the situation and be savvy about it.
People who've made a comeback that it annoys you that they've been able to do that.
Ooh.
I don't know who wrote down Chris Brown, but which we ever put that?
It was
1,000%.
Where do we fucking begin with that?
I just don't. I mean, and you know, saying who's deserving of a comeback feels strange because, in a way, like, who am I or anyone to judge who deserves that? And
Have you not listened to our show for the past few years? That's kind of all we do here.
I know. But I mean, I still believe in, like, that kind of, like, yeah, it's hard to ascertain who deserves that. And I think I do believe in forgiveness. But at the same time, like, Chris Brown is just over and over and over again just been a wretched human being.
And he's not, like, there's no repentance.
No.
And
no maturity and no thought and no consistency of just like, I fucked that up and that was horrible and now I need to be a different type of person. Yes. It's
We need contrition from someone who gets a comeback.
Well, the reason why he doesn't get the comeback is it's almost like an Elvis type scenario. Honestly. In the way that Elvis had the guy who was controlling, was doing all the...
Oh, Colonel.
The Colonel. Oh, mm-hmm. So he had the Colonel who was kind of insulating him from all, like, the, they think you're doing drugs, they think you're going crazy, they think you're too many women, drugs, blah, blah. So he was being insulated by that because he was getting paid. I think that, to some extent, exists. Like, Garagos disappoints me with his allegiance. Like, he tweeted about how Chris got caught up in something a couple weeks ago at his house, and he tweeted and then hashtag Team Breezy. You're an attorney. Like, you need to chill the fuck out. But then at the same time, he has millions, hordes of fans, women, men, the media that just allows him to, it's because, and not to go take this to a totally different direction, but it's because they think that Rihanna's a hoe and they believe a certain narrative about it and think that she played games with him. She egged him on to beat her.
Oh,
and
Lord.
That's truly the narrative that goes on. And instead of her, like, playing, you know, she played into it for a while, like young people do. But then she finally evolved past it.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't evolved past it.
Do you think, too, that, like, the king-making industry was just already too strong on him? I mean, he was called the next Michael Jackson.
He was.
It's like, when you say that about somebody, it's really hard for them to fall down.
True.
I do think, and we got to move on past this in a moment, but with Chris, I do think that it's his fans that kept him in the
game.
Exactly. And which, is, in some ways, makes it even more interesting just because you want to get into the psychology of the fans, and this is exactly the point that Winter was just making. Before we close out, one person that you would love to see make a comeback, Margaret.
A lot of the people on the Facebook group brought up Thora Birch, and I do miss her. I know you're making a face,
but I really, really
adored her in Ghost World and American Beauty. And I feel like she's one of those actresses that had this super bright flame up and then just fell down and disappeared.
I don't think she – I mean, the only reason I made the face is I don't feel like she was really even big enough to warrant a term like comeback because she was never –
I think she was in certain circles.
Right.
I think Ghost World was like – I mean, for me, I adore that movie. And I think there's a lot of people out there that like really saw something of themselves in her and her portrayal, and then she just – fell off.
And especially if you compare that with the success of Scarlett Johansson coming out of the same film over that same time frame.
Somebody I think who didn't get a fair shot once they made it big and has been forcing a comeback to little success is Halle Berry. I think that she is still like so she's talented in the right product. And she's just been either – I know she just switched her entire team up, which I hope bears some better fruit. But, like, I remember there was a time where I was, you know, talking to her team about getting her on Instagram. This was, like, 5 years ago. And it was, like, the narrative was, like, she'd never do that. And then I always feel bad when celebrities eventually get on social media because it means that they're now they're trying to drum up something. So I feel like she is, even at 50, still so gorgeous, still so beautiful. But she is – she's never gotten a fair shot post the make it feel good daddy role in
Monster Ball.
Never got like she won the Oscar and she had like a complete anxiety attack meltdown and then everybody was like
that was
oh
so long ago
that
too.
Was that yeah was like and it's been
12-13 years
Jesus years Christ. Ago
wow.
And ever since then she did the Bond movie she looked great. She's a Bond girl.
It was a bad film though is what I'm saying.
It was that and then she got paid per titty for Swordfish and then
oh lord.
So then since then
she's done like, X-Men and that's what
X-Men,
else yeah right.
And then it's just like okay, why is she not? And the thing is, for a while, it was like you're doing like Janet Jackson's due for a comeback. You go, you do a Tyler Perry movie, you step up, and that's what I'm talking about. People not willing to just take that chance.
If you could engineer her comeback, what do you think would be the best vehicle for Halle Berry?
She needs to either do. She already tried doing a TV show, but that was like so existential and like weird, and like I didn't care.
What show was it? I forget.
Extant.
Oh. Okay, literally was existing.
Where her alien baby might be, I don't know.
Oh my God, you're right. That totally. Anyways, okay.
If I were to engineer her comeback, she'd play like the third or fourth lead in a comedy. She'd have like a Tilda Swinton type, like in Trainwreck type role, something like when Tom Cruise played the studio boss in Tropic Thunder, like something like that where you just don't expect it. You got to do stuff like that. And if she wasn't willing to do something like that, a Tyler Perry movie.
You say that with such resignation. It's like,
because,
well, that's
like,
always available to her.
It's always available to her. But you know what? It's like Heather Locklear's on a Tyler Perry show. I never thought she'd do that. But where the F is she going to go? She's utility actress. She's been working since before I was born. You feel comfortable when you see her on the screen. You know she's bringing the bitchy.
You know, with Halle Berry, though, I feel like she suffers because Hollywood doesn't know what to do with, like, a sensitive, soulful black actress. You know what I mean? Like,
they
if
need
she,
you to be one or the other.
Yeah. If she was super sassy and bring in the, like, snaps, they would know what to do with that. Yeah. But
she's
not that type of person.
Yeah.
If
she was, like, not as what you would say conventionally sexy, like a Viola Davis or Alfre Woodard, they know exactly what to do with her. But she evokes things in men, women, young. She threatens maybe some insecure white women. I don't know. She's just so beautiful. And then there's also like people saying that she might be crazy. And I just think like, fuck all of that noise. She lives in Malibu.
Who isn't
she fucks
crazy
hot
in,
guys.
In Hollywood?
Exactly.
Come on. Who cares? Yeah.
I want her to make a if anybody needs to have a comeback, it really should be Halle Berry or Janet Jackson, even though I feel like it's just too late for Janet.
I would like to stay on the sports tip. I think Venus Williams needs to have one last blazing run because she has been, I mean, when she first came out, she was the Key Williams sister, but then Serena rose and has become, you know, one of the most dominant American athletes for the last 10 years. Venus probably only has a couple of good years left before she's going to retire. And I think she's, I mean, she, it's not like she's bitter with Serena's success. The two of them played doubles together. They win all kinds of majors that way.
She made them lose, though.
But I would love to see Venus have one more, you know, maybe winning the U.S. Open or Wimbledon, something along those lines. Just one last shining moment. And then, you know, she can go into her retirement and find something else. But I think that is what I would like. I would love to see that. All right. This is Pop Rocket. We're going to be back in just a moment with our jams.
Good news, everyone. There are still a few tickets remaining for the London Podcast Festival, September 22nd through 26th. We've just announced a dazzling new addition to the Bullseye lineup. Sharon Horgan, creator and star of the hit shows Pulling and Catastrophe, as well as a new show, Divorce, which launches soon on HBO. Comedian Josie Long, Veep creator Armando Iannucci, and musician Romare round out the Bullseye lineup. But the fun doesn't stop there, friends. International Waters and Judge John Hodgman tickets are still available, too. Do not sleep on this. Feast your eyes on the juicy full lineup and grab your tickets right now at MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your guest host for this week, sitting in for Guy Brand. I'm Oliver Wang, and with me in the studio we have...
Margaret Wappler.
And Winter Mitchell.
And is Flynn still here? Flynn Wappler still
Flynn
here.
Flynn Wappler Earl, who is napping very quietly.
Under the chair. I thought he'd gone out, maybe
so
gone
well
out to
behaved.
Get a burrito or something.
No, he never leaves my side.
We're going to talk about our jams. I should acknowledge that we left last week with a very quick debate about the jam of the 2000s. And we threw it to the Facebook group. And Margaret, will you announce what the Facebook group decided was the jam of the 2000s?
The jam of the 2000s is Hey Ya by Outkast, which we were just saying they
agreed.
Deserve.
Agreed. You agree with that?
I do. I mean, I was going to grad school at the time, and that song was ubiquitous. Every single party I went to in that period of my life, that song played. And it like didn't
does it
matter.
Hold up?
I think it does. I think I still have fun hearing it.
How about for you, Winner? Did you feel like that was the right winner?
No.
For you? Yeah.
No.
What would you have gone with?
Toxic. Mm. Toxic was just such a good. And then my second would have been Destiny's Child.
I thought Crazy in Love, which would have been my choice, would have been much higher.
Oh, it wasn't. It
came
Destiny's
in like
Child
number six or seven. It was much. I don't know. I was really surprised by that.
I feel like there's just so many Beyonce songs that one seems to have fallen. Yeah, it's fallen
right.
Low at this point.
Got it. Margaret, what is your jam for this week?
My jam is El Perro del Mar. It's a song called Bread and Butter. She's a Swedish singer. This is from her fifth album called Kokoro. So it has this interesting, like, Far East kind of flavoring, and apparently she's been listening to a lot of Japanese, Korean, Cambodian pop, and I think it's interesting the way she's sliding it in to this particular song.
I think Americans in general really underestimate how much Sweden gives us in terms of our pop culture, in terms of television shows and music.
I know.
They're such a big part of it, and we just have no idea because we're Americans and we're parochial and we just don't pay attention to these things.
Yeah, I also find that Sweden, like the way that they are combining certain pop culture things is so fascinating.
For example?
Well, just the Far East influences
oh, okay.
in that song,
yeah.
you know, yeah. like it's just a completely, I think, different conception the way like an American would approach it.
Yeah. My jam for this week is inspired by, I did a wedding gig up in San Francisco this past weekend. Shout out to Allison and Sean, who are currently in Kauai. I told them to go to the Westernmost bookstore, which I'd mentioned the other week, which is in a little town called Hanapepe on the island. In any case, there's a moment where I'm DJing, especially for the couple, where I want to be able to nail the song choices that they want, except that they didn't request it. So I want to be able to read them, basically. And so my second favorite moment during the wedding was playing Doris Troy's Just One Look, which is basically the best song ever recorded. And the bride's mom was singing along to it, which is always fun.
That's adorable.
But the song I picked for my jam was the moment that it was not a song they had requested specifically, but I tried to read them and I dropped it in. And both the bride and groom looked at me with that good choice look. That's all I was waiting for. It is the Hot 8 Brass Band's cover out of New Orleans of Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing. What's especially fun about this song is that if you've never heard it, it takes at least 30 seconds or more to figure out what it is exactly.
Yeah.
And so people are kind of going with it. And once they realize it's the Marvin Gaye song, then they really get into it. And I love that element of surprise with it. Winner, take us home. What is your jam?
Breaking news. George H.W. Bush is going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Oh.
Wow. That is my jam.
That is a jam.
That just broke. So forget whatever I was just about to fucking play. I literally just opened my phone right now and looked at Twitter because, you know, Oliver was telling a story about weddings and DJing.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Oh. Winter went into pilot
mode. I'm kidding.
No, I don't blame
kidding.
You.
I'm kidding.
I don't blame you.
No, I'm glad you make that tertiary income. Listen.
Otherwise known as the side hustle.
I'm kidding.
Academic side hustle.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I love you, Oliver.
Yeah, okay.
No.
But really, though.
No, but really, though.
That's crazy, though.
Breaking news.
That is breaking news. Except by the time this airs, people, you know.
Right. Guess what Trump's going to say.
There'll be a million think pieces about
it. There will be. But Trump's going to say.
Will he say, like, that's the green Skittles fault or whatever?
He's going to say that it's because he's older and he's fallen a couple of times.
He's lost his faculties.
Because
that's how he rolls.
Because he's going to fuck around. George H.W. Bush has beaten my jam.
Okay.
That's my jam.
All right. That is the jam, then. All right. You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Oliver Wang, sitting for Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell and Margaret Wappler. Our theme music is... What is our theme music, people?
Ozomizo
Booby Trap.
Booby Trap.
Yay. I love it. I fall asleep to it every night.
That's a high compliment, I hope. No, it's Party Booby Trap by Ozomizo. Thank you for letting us use it. If you got an opinion you would want to share about this week's topics, you can join the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We're at Pop Rocket. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Christian Duenas and the brand new Kara Hart. We have a new producer in the mix.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.